Here comes the cable news for Monday, March 13th. I'm Blaine Palmer.
And I'm Chris Andre.
The Oregon Teachers Union is refusing to endorse Governor Ted Kulongoski in the upcoming primary elections. Democratic Senator Russ Feingold is proposing censuring Bush for authorizing an illegal spy program. Slobodan Milosevic has died of an apparent heart attack. All those stories and more coming up on the Cable Morning News. Portland area weather today, patchy fog in the morning to the north. A chance of rain later, highs in the upper 40s to 50s. Oregon's powerful teachers union dealt a painful blow to Governor Ted Kulongoski on Saturday by refusing to endorse his re-election campaign. Instead, the 45,000-member Oregon Education Association decided, after three rounds of balloting, to stay neutral. Delegates to the union's political convention came within a few percentage points of handing the endorsement to one of Kulongoski's Democratic primary rivals, Lane County Commissioner Pete Sorensen. Several OEA members complained that the governor hasn't done enough to boost funding for education. Larry Wolf, the union's president, said many teachers were also still upset that in 2003, Kulongoski signed into law reductions in public employee pension benefits. The union, which has spent more than $1 million on gubernatorial and legislative races in 2002, runs the state's largest political fund. Democratic contender Pete Sorensen, who's campaigned for more than a year with little public notice, gained a major victory by outpolling the governor. Sorensen said it shows a tremendous amount of support for a Democrat who's running a populist and grassroots campaign. Sorensen has focused much of his candidacy on a call for higher corporate taxes to help pay for education and other public programs. Unlike with many unions, OEA endorsements are not carefully controlled by the leadership. Instead, about 300 convention delegates cast votes, weighted by the amount of political contributions made by members of the various locals. In addition to Kulongoski and Sorensen, four other candidates courted the teachers: Democrat Jim Hill, Independent Ben Westland, and Republicans Kevin Mannix and Ron Saxton. This from the Oregonian.
Governor Ted Kulongoski wants all the electricity used by state agencies to come from renewable sources such as wind and sun power, and he wants that done in an ambitious 4 years. It's a goal whose timeline would dovetail neatly with the end of the Democrats' second four-year term. Kulongoski had previously set the mark at 100% by 2025 before deciding to ramp up the schedule as a way to create jobs and set an example in responsible energy consumption. Kulongoski gave no specifics on public investment costs, potential savings, or ways to meet a goal that would make Oregon the first in the nation. He promised that the state departments of administrative services and energy would deliver options to him by July. State government spends about $26 million a year on electricity, which makes up roughly one-third of energy consumed. Currently, about 1% of state agencies' electricity comes from renewable sources. Renewable energy and consumer advocates call the governor's proposal feasible. They praised his aggressiveness in developing new energy through wind and solar generators, geothermal, and plant matter biomass. Advocates also said it's especially timely as Oregonians worry about global warming and soaring fuel costs. At the same time, there's dwindling room to develop additional sites to generate hydroelectric power. This according to the Oregonian.
The four Democrats who are vying to unseat U.S. Representative Greg Walden of Hood River will hit the road together for the next 7 weekends until the May 16th primary arrives. The foursome will visit all of the counties in Oregon's sprawling 2nd Congressional District. The district stretches from Grants Pass and Medford to the Idaho border, and it includes every county on the east side of the Cascades. Pat Ackley is a Sun River Democratic activist who coordinates the party activities in the district. He said the candidates recognize that one of them will come out on top, and the intent is for all of them to be on the same platform, not bashing each other, but taking on Walden. Democrats who hope to earn their party nomination in May are Charles H. Butcher, Baker City contractor and gun rights activist, Dan Davis, a Jacksonville entrepreneur and military veteran, Carol Voisin, an Ashland College instructor, and Scott Silver of Bend, an activist for free access to federal forests. Silver said the speaking series simplifies logistics and offers candidates something that might be tough to achieve individually, rooms filled with voters.
County commissioners from across Oregon made a pilgrimage to Washington this week to lobby for renewal of a law that guarantees money to counties with federal forest land, including $280 million a year to Oregon. The program the commissioners are lobbying for sends money to county governments and every school district in the state. With the law set to expire in September, the Bush administration proposed a 5-year extension, but with payments guaranteed at only about half what they are now. Navigating the extension through a tight budget environment in Washington, D.C. won't be easy. So commissioners are working now on crafting a strategy, from showing the fallout on public services without federal money to demonstrating how the money has held communities together through hard times. If the law expires, many timber counties would have bigger claims under another federal program that applies to all types of federal property. That could leave a smaller pot of money for those counties. Greg Walden, Oregon's only Republican in the House of Representatives, said he's supportive of the lobbying efforts, but cautions that the law was first passed 6 years ago at the height of an economic boom and with little talk of budget cuts. Walden and other members of the Oregon delegation are developing a list of potential offsets to help cover county payment guarantees for at least the next 5 years. He won't name the programs he plans to target, saying members from other states might try to claim the same offsets for pet programs of their own.
Since the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks on the East Coast, Oregon legislators have chipped away at the state's public records law by approving more than 30 bills, putting records out of the public's reach or limiting access to those records. However, most of the record closings or restrictions passed since 2001 stem more from personal privacy concerns and worries about such issues as identity theft than from fears of terrorism. Whatever the motivation, open records advocates say the exemptions are undermining Oregon's 1973 public records law that was designed to build people's confidence in government by allowing unfettered public access to government documents. One of the most contentious bills was debated in the legislature's 2003 sessions, when local governments and utilities pushed for a bill to close records pertaining to plans for protecting utility facilities and other key installations from potential sabotage. Gas company officials and others argued that with the United States under a continuing threat of a terrorist attack, it doesn't benefit the public to have those security plans as part of the public record. In the end, the 2003 legislation was narrowed following news media protests that it would have given government bodies and utilities too much authority to decide what would be kept secret. But Kevin Neely of the Oregon Attorney General's Office estimates that 3/4 of the record-closing exemptions or restrictions approved by Oregon lawmakers in the 2003 and 2005 sessions are the result of personal privacy concerns.
Granny D, also known as Doris Haddock, became a national hero in 1999 when she walked across America for campaign finance reform. Now she's 96 years old and still lecturing around the country. KBOO's Martha Odom caught up with Granny D last Thursday night at the University of Portland.
What's your motivation? What's your inspiration? How do you keep doing what you do?
I have 16 great-grandchildren, and I want them to have a different kind of legacy than they are having, that it looks like they might get. And I have nothing else I need to do. And so I've been working since 2000, going from state to state, trying to increase the interest in public funding for our elections at the state level.
Are you disappointed at how slowly campaign finance reform is progressing?
No, I think that it's doing well.
Yeah.
That when I started in 1998, people asked me, what does it mean? Now they know. And I don't think there's a politician that's running for office today that doesn't mention campaign finance reform.
Is it true that you skied into New York on your walk across the country?
Yes, that's very true. It looked as if we had 12 inches of unexpected snow, and walking on the pavement, the sides of the road were covered with snow, and you ended up in a dangerous spot. So it looked as if we were being illegal and probably told to stop. And then they told me about this CNO canal, which was beside a path beside it. And it had, when the railroad was completed, they didn't need this this canal anymore, and it was the path was abandoned, but someone was bright enough to turn it into a national park.
You're an amazing woman and an inspiration to us. Are there words you would like to pass on to the Portland, well, to the KBOO community? Some days seem a little bit dark and hard, and we're looking for all the inspiration we can find.
Well, I think that that we are having a velvet revolution, as they did in Czechoslovakia. That I feel very strongly that that what we do, we cast aside anger and transfer it into love, and work very hard towards getting back our democracy.
Thank you so much. For KBOO Community Radio, this is Martha Odom reporting.
Republican contenders for the White House walked a political tightrope at a weekend gathering of party activists. According to Reuters, while praising Bush's leadership, they condemned runaway government spending, rising debt, and expanding bureaucracies. The conference offered a glimpse of the future for a party contemplating life after Bush. With November's congressional election looming and approval ratings skidding for Bush and the Republican-led Congress, attendees said the party had strayed from its core principles of limited government, fiscal responsibility, and conservative social values. While every speaker pledged loyalty to Bush, many attendees said it was time to move on. Something was broken in Washington, and they want a leader who can fix it. Conference participants voted in a straw poll to choose an early favorite. Tennessee Senator Bill Frist, who packed the home state crowd with supporters, won easily over second-place finisher Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney. Arizona Governor John McCain urged participants to support Bush by writing in the president's name, and Bush finished in a tie for third with Virginia Governor George Allen.
Liberal Democrat and potential White House contender Russ Feingold is proposing censuring President Bush for authorizing domestic eavesdropping. Feingold says the White House misled Americans about its legality. He told the AP the president has broken the law, and in some way he must be held accountable. A censure resolution which simply would scold the president has been used just once in U.S. history against Andrew Jackson in 1834. Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist called the proposal a crazy political move. The five-page resolution to be introduced today contends that Bush violated the law when, on his own, he set up the eavesdropping program within the National Security Agency in the months following the attacks of September 11th. Bush claims that his authority as commander-in-chief, as well as a September 2001 congressional authorization to use force in the fight against terrorism, gave him the power to authorize the surveillance. The resolution says the president repeatedly misled the public before the disclosure of the NSA program last December, when he indicated the administration was relying on court orders to wiretap terror suspects inside the U.S. In the House of Representatives, John Conyers of Michigan, the top Democrat on the House Judiciary Committee, is pushing legislation that would call on the Republican-controlled Congress to determine whether there are grounds for impeachment.
The top Democrat on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee said U.S. should pull troops from Iraq after this summer if the political conditions in the country do not improve. Senator Joseph Biden said the Iraqis must have a constitution that unites fighting factions of the society or it's game over. Biden said if he knew what he knows now, when Congress voted on the Iraq War resolution, he would have opposed it. He said this has been a debacle. Republican Senator George Allen of Virginia said he agrees that it is vitally important for the Iraqis elected in February's parliamentary elections to form a government. But Allen, also a presidential hopeful, said he is unwilling to set a specific deadline. Allen said the situation among the Kurds, Shiites, and Sunnis is going tough. Presidential adviser Karl Rove said Saturday that the Bush administration will not pull American troops out of Iraq until victory is achieved, despite the growing number of Democrats urging a withdrawal.
With U.S. casualties rising in wars overseas, many young people are shunning a career in the armed forces, but recruiting is still a two-way street. And the military, too, doesn't want most people in this prime recruiting age group of 17 to 24. Of some 32 million Americans now in this group, the Army deems the vast majority too obese, too uneducated, too flawed in some way, according to its estimates for the current budget year. Previous Defense Department studies have found that 75% of young people are ineligible for military service.
Lapses by private port operators, shipping lines, or truck drivers could allow terrorists to smuggle weapons of mass destruction into the United States. That's according to a government review of security at U.S. ports. $75 million three-year study by the Homeland Security Department included inspections at a New Jersey cargo terminal involved in the dispute over Dubai Company's now abandoned bid to take over significant operations at six U.S. ports. According to government documents marked sensitive security information, the previously undisclosed results from the study found that cargo containers can be opened secretly during shipment to add or remove items without alerting U.S. authorities. The study found serious lapses by private companies at foreign and U.S. ports, aboard ships, and on trucks and trains that would enable unmanifested materials or weapons of mass destruction to be introduced into the supply chain.
Donald Rumsfeld has made a killing out of bird flu. The U.S. Defense Secretary has made more than $5 million in capital gains from selling shares in the biotechnology firm that discovered and developed Tamiflu. The drugs being bought in massive amounts by governments to treat a possible human pandemic of the disease. More than 60 countries have so far ordered large stocks of the antiviral medication, the only oral medicine believed to be effective against the deadly H5N1 strain of the disease. Rumsfeld was on the board of Gilead from 1988 to 2001. Gilead is the company that manufactures Tamiflu. Rumsfeld was its chairman from 1997, and then he left to join the Bush administration, but retained a huge shareholding. Rumsfeld sold some of his Gilead shares in 2004, reaping capital gains of more than $5 million. A report shows that he still had up to $25 million worth of shares at the end of 2004. At least one analyst believes his stake has grown well beyond that figure. This from The Independent.
As the dispute over its nuclear program arrives at the UN Security Council today, Iran has vaulted to the front of the U.S. national security agenda. According to the Washington Post, the Bush administration has plans for a sustained campaign against the Ayatollahs of Tehran. President Bush and his team have been huddling in closed-door meetings on Iran, summoning scholars for advice. They've been investing in opposition activities, creating an Iran office in Washington, and opening listening posts abroad dedicated to the efforts against Tehran. The administration also has launched a $75 million program to advance democracy in Iran by expanding broadcasting into the country, funding non-governmental organizations, and promoting cultural exchanges. Some analysts believe that this year will lead to a decision point for Bush whether to use a military option. This according to the Washington Post.
The Washington Post plans to cut 80 positions from its editorial staff as it grapples with a steadily declining circulation. A union representative said the cuts, which are expected to occur within a year, would come through buyouts and attrition. There are about 800 people at the paper's news operation, including reporters, editors, and administrative staff. About 600 are represented by the union. The cuts come as the Post and other newspapers are coping with falling circulation and an advertising slump as more people turn to free websites to get their news. The Post is building up its website with internet-only blogs and chat sessions with Post and Post.com staff. It's also launched a radio station.
While lawyers argued and jury considered whether Zacharias Moussaoui should live or die, the convicted September 11th conspirator mouthed al-Qaeda fight songs, cursed America, and smiled as witnesses recounted the deadly hijackings. Moussaoui seemed to savor moments when he could shout, "God curse America," and "God bless Osama bin Laden." But he was careful not to do so, He was careful to do so out of earshot of the jury that will decide if he's to be executed. Massawi's on trial to determine whether he gets the death penalty or life in prison. The sentencing trial started March 6th and could last up to 3 months.
The preliminary results of an autopsy in the Netherlands on Slobodan Milosevic show the former Yugoslav leader died of a heart attack on the weekend. He was found dead in his cell on Saturday in The Hague, where he was on trial for war crimes. A toxicological report on the body is still to be completed amid allegations he may have died of poisoning. An official for the UN tribunal said his remains would be released on Monday to the family. The tribunal said that the full autopsy report might take more than another day to be released, but that the preliminary results showed Milosevic had died of a myocardial infarction. Milosevic had been suffering from two heart conditions, according to his lawyer. Milosevic feared he was being poisoned just a day before he died in his cell. This from the BBC.
Police found the bodies of four men dangling from electrical pylons today in a Baghdad Shiite slum. Hours before, car bombs and mortar shells ripped through busy market streets, killing at least 58 people and wounding more than 200. The grim scene added to fears that yesterday's bloody assault on a stronghold of radical Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr would plunge Iraq into another frenzy of sectarian killing. Bomb blasts in Baghdad, Kirkuk, and Tikrit, many of them targeting Iraqi police patrols, killed at least 10 more people today and wounded more than 30. They included a U.S. soldier killed in a roadside bombing in East Baghdad. A U.S. Marine was reported killed on Sunday in the province of Anbar.
France's Dominique de Villepin pledged yesterday to apply a youth labor law that has triggered protests, but he offered guarantees to head off criticism of the measure. The Conservative Prime Minister denied in a television interview he was isolated over the plan to loosen France's rigid labor laws for people under the age of 26. And he invited unions to talk starting in April on ways to combat job insecurity. Villepin said, "When youth unemployment in the suburbs is 40 to 50%, what do we do? Judging by the comments of some people, you'd think everything is going well. What do we do? Just hold our arms, as we have done for years, or tackle the problem?" Villepin was speaking on TF1 television a day after riot police smashed their way into Paris' Sorbonne University to end the first student occupation there since May 1968 student revolt that weakened his political idol Charles de Gaulle. The three-day student sit-in was the climax of a week of protests affecting half of France's 80 university faculties. This according to Reuters.
The African Union voted to extend its peacekeeping mission in Sudan's troubled Darfur region until September 30th. The decision comes after intense lobbying by the U.S. and European countries to transfer the operation to United Nations control. FSRN's Haider Rizvi reports from the U.N.
Under pressure from Western nations, including the United States, the U.N. wanted to replace the African Union force in Darfur with its own peacekeepers. But the Sudanese government strongly opposed this move by saying that the UN should rather help African peacekeepers who are running out of money. Currently, there is a 7,000-strong African Union force in Darfur to mitigate the ongoing bloody conflict between the Sudanese Arab militia and the indigenous rebel forces. The Sudanese government has been accused of backing the militia, which is seen as responsible for mass killings and uprooting millions of indigenous civilians in the Darfur region. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Heather Rizvi at the United Nations.
Britain has been secretly designing a new nuclear warhead in conjunction with the Americans, provoking a legal row over the proliferation of such weapons, according to the Times of London. The government has been pushing ahead with the program while claiming that no decision has been made on a successor to Britain's Trident nuclear deterrent. Work on a new weapons system by scientists at the Atomic Weapons Establishment at Aldermaston in Berkshire has been underway since Tony Blair was re-elected last May and is now said to be ahead of similar U.S. research. The aim is to produce a simpler device using proven components to avoid breaching the ban on nuclear testing. The secret program to build a new warhead in close cooperation with America will spark anger among Labour opponents of any replacement of the Trident program, which is estimated to have cost nearly £10 billion. Developing a new weapon would also be a material breach of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. The Office of Lord Goldsmith, the Attorney General, refused to comment on whether it had been asked for legal advice by No. 10 Downing Street. Both Labour backbenchers and Liberal Democrats accused the government of introducing a replacement nuclear weapon by the back door without parliamentary debate.
North Korea accused the United States yesterday of stepping up preparations to attack and said that justified their nuclear weapons program. North Korea's Minju Joseon newspaper cited planned drills with South Korea and other U.S. military activity in the Asia-Pacific region as evidence Washington was preparing to invade. A day earlier, the North put off cabinet-level talks with the South to protest the joint military exercises. The week-long exercises later this month will involve 20,000 American troops and an undisclosed number of South Korean soldiers. The United States and South Korea characterize them as purely defensive. North Korea claims it has atomic weapons and usually refers to its nuclear arsenal as a nuclear deterrent force. That claim has not been verified independently.
Chile inaugurated its first female president Saturday. From Santiago, FSRN, Jorge Garatón explains what to expect from the incoming president.
Michelle Bachelet will become this Saturday Chile's first female president. She is promising a new style of government and has already appointed an equal number of women and men to her cabinet and to other high-level positions. Bachelet says her government will focus on three key points. First, the construction of a new safety net that includes mandatory early childhood education and a reform to the private pension plan system. Second, government investment in creative entrepreneurship, particularly for small-scale business owners. And her third point is to actively involve Chileans in public policy decisions by institutionalizing formal citizen consultation for specific policy making. Over 30 heads of state are expected to attend Bachelet's inauguration ceremony tomorrow. For FSRN, this is Jorge Garretón in Santiago.
And this has been the KBOO Morning News from Monday, March 13th, 2006. Chris Andre edited the news, KBOO volunteers edited the tape stories, and Jim Thompson is on the board right now. The KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director is Kathleen Stevenson. I'm Chris Andre.
And I'm Blaine Palmer.
Portland area weather today, patchy fog in the morning to the north, chance of rain later, highs in the upper 40s to 50s. Tonight, showers likely, snow in the mountains, lows in the 30s. Thanks for listening. We clear the air at 90.7 FM in Portland, 100.7 FM in Corvallis on translator K264AA, 91.9 FM in Hood River on translator K220HR. Be sure to join us this evening at 5 p.m. for the KBOO Evening News. Wondering what to do with all that news on your mind? Volunteer in the KBOO Morning Newsroom. Call Kathleen Stevenson at 503-231-8032, extension 202, to find out how you can get involved. Or visit our website, www.kboo.fm. Coming up on the KBOO Morning Zine this morning.
At 7:30, Cecil and Celeste host More Talk Radio. Their guest is Earl Ofari Hutchinson, author and political and social issues commentator. The focus is the use of immigration as a wedge issue within the black community and how the real concerns of blacks are only being exploited, not addressed. At 9, it's the Old Mole Variety Hour. At 10, on Health Watch, Dr. David Naiman hosts a roundtable discussion with a naturopathic physician and a Chinese herbalist and acupuncturist about chronic pain and headaches. 10:30, it's the Dirt Bag with host Glenn Andreessen discussing tasks in the produce garden, including cover crops, compost, and starting veggies. And at 11, it's Democracy Now! Thanks for listening to the KBOO Morning News.